From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We have reached the point in our quadrennial cycle when political pollsters begin to descend on the American people by phone, usually during dinner. But there's another less intrusive way to track your mood when you're not bothered, when your views drop unsolicited from your fingertips: Twitter. That company has teamed up with Republican and Democratic pollsters, as well as a social data company called Topsy, to create a new tool called the Twindex, which offers a new and possibly even more accurate way to gauge the political leanings of likely voters. Adam Sharp is Twitter's manager for government and politics. He says the Twindex contains a nearly unfathomable amount of data.
Election Day 2008, there were 1.8 million tweets worldwide. We now see that volume about every 6 minutes. And so this now gives us a really deep river to pull tweets out of for study.
While the sample size is obviously vast, it's also not randomized. Does the composition of the Twitter user base skew the results? For example, does it skew young? Does it skew left?
It's important to note that this isn't measuring the opinions of every user on Twitter. It is measuring the opinions of those who are actively talking about the campaign or talking about the individual candidates.
So it is skewed. It's skewed towards the politically engaged, who are the people who presumably vote to begin with.
Exactly. And when you recognize that one of the challenges in traditional polling is often how do you define what's a likely voter, because someone will always say on the phone that they're going to vote but then don't. We would hypothesize that someone who talks about politics every day is more likely to vote than someone who doesn't. Also, another challenge in traditional polling has been reaching people who no longer have a landline telephone. Close to 60% of Twitter users use Twitter on a mobile device. So that's an area where we may actually be a little bit stronger. And we were very encouraged when we found that there was no natural skew. President Obama and Governor Romney, over the last several months, their average Twitter political index values are actually very close to each other. Also, when we looked at our data on the president for the last 2 years, we found a relatively strong correlation with other traditional polling like the Gallup approval poll.
I don't know if that should make you happier or Gallup, which with a small randomized sample seems to be absolutely capturing the zeitgeist. I mean, who should be giving the high fives, you or the polling industry?
When all the dials point the same direction, that should make both sides excited because that reinforces the findings we each have. When the dials point in different directions, however, that is when the Twindex is surfacing some conversation that is happening that isn't necessarily being measured in the traditional polls.
For example?
The raid in Pakistan that killed Osama bin Laden. Both the Gallup approval number and the Twitter political index shot up following that weekend. But you saw a much quicker drop-off in the daily Twindex values than you did in the Gallup numbers. And when we dug into the tweets for that two-month period, we discovered there were more tweets on the economy than on all national security issues combined, including bin Laden, which had been the number one most tweeted news event in Twitter's history up to that point. That a month after the bin Laden raid, if a pollster calls you and says, "Do you think the president is doing a good job?" you pause, you reflect, you remember the bin Laden raid, and say yes. But you're not necessarily going to the coffee shop with your friends and coworkers every day and saying, "Great news, bin Laden is still dead." You're going back to the same pocketbook, impactful issues that have been affecting your life beforehand. And that is where that natural conversation is diverging from that reflective pause that you're measuring in the traditional poll.
Were there any other political insights that you were able to divine from Twindex that neither the traditional polling organizations nor the press were on top of as quickly as you were?
There's a large spike for the president in late summer of last year, and then it drops off again earlier this year. Each of those shifts were completely contrary to what the public opinion polls were showing at the time. We discovered that last August, during the debt ceiling debate in Congress, the president went on national television and urged Americans to tweet their congressman. Over a period of several weeks, you had very strong investment from the Obama campaign in activating their base on Twitter and essentially turning them out to vote with their tweets. But he had no general election opponent at that point. When you fast forward to March into May of this year, conservatives on Twitter had begun to align more behind Governor Romney, and people who had been tweeting against other Republican candidates were now focusing their attention on the president. You actually saw the president come back to his original numbers.
But in terms of understanding the electorate, have you just identified a liability that it can be manipulated by going directly to the user base and asking them to start a tweeting?
It actually gave us a measure of the ability to motivate the base, which, particularly when you get closer to the election and you're looking at the need to drive turnout, can be an important measure that doesn't always surface in traditional polling. That lift was a measure of essentially what it looks like when one candidate is able to motivate their base without a response on the other side. As we head into 2012, we wouldn't expect to see that same pattern because the presumption is that if Obama motivates his people on one side of the issue, the Romney campaign would motivate them on the other side. And if you did see a shift, well, that would be exactly the result you're looking for because it would give you a measure of which candidate was being more effective in that effort.
A moment ago, I was asking you whether the people at Gallup organization, for example, should be exchanging high fives because Twindex proves that their methodology has been very good all along. But polling is expensive, and crunching Twitter data is cheap. And I wonder if Gallup and the rest of the polling industry should be worried about being squeezed out of business.
This is an exciting experiment to see how Twitter data can be used. Now, having demonstrated that this data set is available and is large enough and diverse enough to provide credible results, this now creates opportunities for other polling firms and other data analysis firms to enter this space and iterate on this further. Hopefully, it gets better and better and better with every iteration.
That was not an entirely direct response, but a very diplomatic one. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Adam Sharp is Twitter's Manager for Government and Politics. Kids, as you know, say the darndest things. Politicians usually don't. In this age of being obsessively on message and where an errant slip of the tongue can end a campaign in an instant, our elected leaders are nothing if not careful, which makes rescinding a tweet such a funny exercise. And unless a vigilant eye has seen the tweet come and go, most of us are none the wiser. Until now, Tom Lee is director of the Sunlight Labs group of the Sunlight Foundation and heads up something called Politwoops, where retracted tweets are resurrected. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So there have been times, and I think the late Andrew Breitbart did this famously, where a politician was caught sending out something unseemly. I'm talking about Anthony Weiner now, and retracted it, but Breitbart found it and shared it with the world. You have this process now automated.
Right. We don't want to rely on happenstance or the good luck of having a reporter paying attention when news happens. We want to make sure that this information is accessible to everybody and that people can make individual judgments about what's newsworthy or not.
Now, I already talked about Anthony Weiner. Can you give me some other examples of political tweets that the politicians tried to erase from history?
Sure. Probably the most politically relevant one is Jeff Miller, Republican from Florida. Shortly before we launched, he or someone in his office tweeted a link to an online poll that questioned whether or not the president was born in the United States. This was a relatively big story, and ultimately it led to him deleting his Twitter account. We had one instance of a legislator tweeting back at a follower who'd said something nice about their position, I think, on taxes or the deficit, only to then notice that the Twitter handle of their follower was, I think, Campy's Porn Shack, and then clawed it back. It's not possible to be perfect at all times, you know? And I hope that we can be a part of conveying that lesson, that we'll eventually be able to accept these folks as just human beings, not perfectly manicured and polished specimens.
All right. Now, I'm glad you brought up that subject, because on the face of it, Politwoops sounds like just the latest iteration of the gotcha culture that has just so sullied the political process in this country. Is this just the automation of gotcha?
I don't really think so. I think that there's already enough people paying attention to each lawmaker's account that the next Anthony Weiner is going to be caught and screenshotted right away. Politwoops is stuff that's a little bit more charming and personal, by and large. My favorite example from the site is Newt Gingrich tweeting excitedly about being on Leno that evening and saying that he hopes that Snooki, his fellow guest, likes zoos and animals, which I don't think is an instance of gotcha at all. It's just sort of a charming window into how this guy is thinking about the next media appearance he's got on what I'm sure is a busy schedule. In other cases, you know, it's things like a lawmaker tweeting to compare The Bachelor to The Hunger Games, and I'm not sure why that's pulled back exactly.
Because God forbid they've been caught being humans.
Exactly. For what it's worth, I don't think that lawmakers have to respond to this kind of oversight, I guess, by muzzling themselves. You can look at someone like Chuck Grassley, who is a prolific tweeter, and I think it's fair to say a somewhat ridiculous tweeter in the way that he uses weird abbreviations and actually is really candid, to his credit, in how he communicates with his followers. And, you know, he's received some, I don't know, gentle teasing about that, but it hasn't stopped him, and it shouldn't stop him. You know, I follow a number of lawmakers. One of them that comes to mind is Claire McCaskill, who's really great about sharing the details of her schedule. Sometimes it's campaign-y events, you know, shots with constituents. Other times it's a shot from the treadmill in the hotel where she's staying. And I have a better sense of what her life is like and what her constituents are implicitly asking her to do by electing her.
Now, the Sunlight Foundation was actually an institution that encouraged members of Congress to embrace Twitter. I'm just curious how you think it's gone now that so many lawmakers do, in fact, use the platform.
Twitter, I think, used to be regarded as a toy for politicians or something that just was less important. But it's become a first-class way for legislators to communicate with their constituents. And we think it should be subject to the same standards as other media. You don't get to call a do-over when you give a bad quote or you send out a press release that's wrong or you're photographed with a supporter who turns out to be an extremist or a criminal. Those aren't things that the media or the public allows of legislators through other communications media. So why should social media be different?
Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Lee runs Politwoops, a project of Sunlight Labs at the Sunlight Foundation. We will link to some Politwoops on our website.
Coming up, how a comedian skewering a presidential candidate on Twitter earned more Twitter love than the candidate himself.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Stand-up comedian Rob Delaney's comedy career took off when he began wielding his Twitter account to mock Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney, help! A black man tried to give me health insurance. I'm hiding with my family in my basement. Come get us.
Those Romney tweets have been so popular, in fact, that a study commissioned by Businessweek found that in June, on days when Romney tweeted himself and Delaney tweeted about Romney, Delaney's tweets got retweeted more often, 44% of the time.
Mitt, if you won't release your tax returns, at least tell us what conditioner you use. Hashtag sheen, hashtag luster, hashtag body.
It says something about the perils politicians face communicating their message on Twitter that a comedian could match and sometimes exceed the reach of a presidential candidate just a few months in front of the election.
My other car is a dancing horse. That's a bumper sticker on Mitt Romney's limo.
Rob, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You've said that you've been drawn to tweet about Romney because he fascinates you. It's clear you're not a fan, so what's so fascinating?
Well, the thing about Mitt Romney is his desire to be president is so overwhelming. He just wants it. Like, for example, when he lost, it might have been South Carolina, and the next morning, he said, in the news, he said I liked grits. I said the thing that they wanted to hear. Why didn't they, you know? And it's just, he blows my mind.
So a lot of your tweets about Romney we can't read out loud. But then there are other ones, Rob, that are more political, like, thank you for signing into law the permanent ban on assault weapons in Massachusetts in 2004. You should be proud and campaign on that. Not hilarious.
Mm-mm.
So is the point to mock Romney as a person or Romney's political stances?
I don't care about who the person is. You know, I never wore a Barack Obama t-shirt. Hope and change were always just silly slogans and bumper stickers to me. It's policy stuff that I care about. My dream of dreams
mm-hmm.
is that an undecided voter might read a tweet of mine and think, it made me laugh, but what's he talking about? And then look up the background. Do I hope that I can affect some what I consider positive change? Yes. Will it happen? I don't know. And, you know, it's not my job to care.
There's a long history of comedians mocking politicians. Their political cartoons go back hundreds of years.
Oh, yeah.
On TV, you got your presidential impersonations, your SNL sketches.
Yep.
Twitter, though, seems different.
Twitter is a wonderful meritocracy. One thing that Twitter's been great for is women in comedy, because you've got, you know, the male-dominated comedy writing world, and so many amazing women comedians have shown up. You know, so you can hear a joke from a woman who works at a, you know, auto body shop in Topeka, Kansas. The voice that people can have is kind of remarkable. So you can have a Sheldon Adelson pumping money into the system. Money's very powerful, but if an idea, if a little chunk of truth hits you in the gut, whoa, you know, it's very easy for you to hit retweet and get that out there at a speed that I think is faster than actual lightning.
And it's also been a big boon to your career. It's really helped separate you from many other stand-up comedians out touring on the road. And yet, your stand-up sets don't feature any political jokes, right?
That is correct. The funniest stuff is not the political flavor of the month. The funniest stuff is what's going on within your own body, within your own mind, you know? What are you going to do with a political joke? Smirk? I want to punch you and pummel you and assault you in a stand-up setting with stuff that's going to make you... I mean, I want people to throw up. Because to me, the best stand-up comedy, or Pryor, or a Cosby, or Carlin, although Carlin certainly was political, the stuff that you're like, oh my God, you know, in amazing abdominal pain laughing at is not the political stuff that he did, as amazing as it was and as vital as it was and as much as I study it.
Still, I want to end with your favorite Romney tweet, if you have one.
Okay, I think my favorite Mitt Romney tweet that I did, and it's a quote, and it goes, terrific. Mitt Romney, every time Jar Jar Binks appears on screen. I think that's the one that affects people the most, because Jar Jar Binks was George Lucas kowtowing to an imagined audience, a denial of basic Star Wars universal truths, and an offense.
Which also proves that Twitter is really a great gathering place for nerds.
Big time. Big time. Absolutely.
Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Comedian Rob Delaney, and thanks to the political and social research company VoterTide for walking us through its study of Rob Delaney's tweets. North Korea's new 20-something leader, Kim Jong-un, has been capturing the world's attention with his surprising first months in power. From removing an army chief to endorsing pizza and French fries, food that was previously banned, to stepping out in public with his young, fashionable wife, Kim Jong-un, seems like he is on a mission to differentiate his regime from that of his fathers before him. As reporter Blaine Hardin wrote in Foreign Policy, the new images coming out of North Korea show a friendlier, softer dictator, despite the fact that North Korea remains uniquely oppressive.
Well, I think the most significant difference is that Kim Jong-un is on parade with his young wife. His father, Kim Jong-il, although he married entertainment figures, he never appeared in public with them. Indeed, he never spoke in public at all. His son is taking a different approach. He's out talking on TV a lot, and he's showing off this young woman who he apparently married, and she's just 23 years old to his 28 or 29.
But she doesn't look like a bimbo. She looks smart. She's dressed in a way that's almost business attire.
She looks like a young executive at Samsung in Seoul, which is a look that North Korean women just in the past have never presented in public. They're often dressed as peasants, or else they're painted up to be entertainers. They look slightly bizarre, but she looks like a normal professional woman with a good haircut, with very bright eyes.
There's a video of him visiting a kindergarten where he brings his wife. You say that the music is like Wagner on acid.
The little clips that one sees internationally is quite a bit different than the effect of watching a 30-minute tour of this kindergarten, which looks like Oz. The audience who watches it in North Korea gets a different impression. It's part of the cult of Kim image building. But to the outside, because he's with his wife, it presents a softer, more huggable image. And it's almost as if they seem to be trying to imitate Kate Middleton and Prince William's story. But there's no indication so far that there's real substance behind this change in imaging. In fact, one of the things that's happened under him is there's been a sealing of the border with China. The border with China has been a semi-permeable membrane for the past 15 years, since the famine of the late 90s. And it's allowed an enormous amount of information, of food, warm clothing to come into the country. And if that border remains sealed, North Koreans are going to be in a much worse situation than they were under his father.
His father, despite all this talk of dear leader, was not a popular man, but his father was, Kim Il-sung, and you suggest that Kim Jong-un is trying to model himself after his grandfather.
His grandfather was genuinely popular. He was genuinely mourned when he died. So the grandson, Kim Jong-un, cuts his hair like his grandfather. He dresses like him. There were reports in the South Korean media that he had plastic surgery to make his face look like that of his grandfather.
Do you believe that?
It's quite possible.
Do you think that all of this fuzzy image making is having an impact on the outside world?
North Korea is a master of distraction in its image making. This latest phase of it is huggable, soft, and interesting to people who are interested in royal couples. But they have done other image making, belligerent image making, a nuclear state. What all this does is it keeps the world focused on either the belligerence or the strangeness of the leadership. But the very essence of North Korea has been overwhelmed by the other image making. In any discussion of North Korea, the first topic should be, have you stopped tormenting your people and are they able to eat?
I'm reminded of the coverage of Andropov during his brief reign in the Soviet Union. You know, he liked jazz, he liked Western food. This all seemed to soften him, but he was no softy.
No. Also, it's worth noting that while these soft and wonderful huggable images are coming across to the rest of the world, North Korea is having a very hard time of it. There are torrential floods right now, which follow a severe drought. Between 1 and 2/3 of the people are malnourished. It is a miserable place to live. If there's no change, if the situation remains the same, the contradictions become so much greater, and his chances of ending his reign with a bullet in his head are greater. Over time, he and maybe his very intelligent wife are going to figure that out.
You're judging her intelligence on the basis of her clothes, aren't you, Blaine?
I'm judging her intelligence based on the information available, which is a few pictures. And this is the kind of analysis that exists for North Korea. No one really knows what they're up to.
Blaine, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Blaine Harden is a reporter for PBS Frontline and the author of the book Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. This week in Moscow, closing statements in the notorious Pussy Riot trial. On February 21st, the feminist punk collective Pussy Riot entered Moscow's largest church to produce a video asking for the Virgin Mary to, quote, drive Putin out. Three band members were apprehended and charged with hooliganism motivated by religious hatred. They could face up to 7 years in prison. Defendant Yekaterina Samutsevich told the court, "I now have mixed feelings about this trial. On the one hand, we now expect a guilty verdict. Compared to the judicial machine, we are nobodies, and we have lost. On the other hand, we have won." Now, she says, once again, Russia looks different in the eyes of the world from the way Putin tries to present it. Michael Idov, editor-in-chief of Russian GQ, wrote this week in the New York Times that the Pussy Riot trial was Russia's Nazis in Skokie moment. It's Hustler versus Falwell. But the prosecution is built purely on emotional appeals and imagery, starting with the image of the young women themselves as they appeared in the video.
Pussy Riot are space aliens. I mean, people can't really make heads or tails of them, and the interest that they command in the West is flabbergasting to the Russian public, because the Russians would love to have a pop band cross over and be a big success in the West. The fact that this happened to this, you know, radical artist collective that's not even a band, and now you have, you know, Madonna with the words Pussy Riot written on her back, and you have balaclavas becoming a protest fashion accessory.
Because they wear them to disguise their faces.
Yes, exactly.
Describe these women. Who are they?
Well, actually, if you look at their statements to the court, they are incredibly smart. When we talk about punks and punk rock, you have to realize they're, you know, art student types. Maria Alohina, one of the defendants, her statement to the court included, I think, three instances of the word ontological. This also helps explain why the Russian musicians don't really speak up for them. Partly it's because they're afraid, but partly it's also because they're not really perceived as musicians in Russia, whereas when you look at them from the West, they actually form a much more familiar picture of sort of this edgy, you know, punk band.
Mm-hmm. They really seem to have the ability to enrage. Do you think it's because they pulled this stunt in a place regarded as holy, and that was a shocking and painful act of disrespect? That's the prosecution's argument.
The Church of Christ the Savior, and the fact that they picked that church, is very telling, because it's the church that was destroyed by Stalin and turned into a swimming pool. And then it was rebuilt after the fall of the Soviet Union, but it remains unloved. It's the official seat of the Orthodox Church, and as such, it's seen almost like a ministry, and I mean the ministry in the political sense of the word. By choosing the Church of Christ the Savior, I think Pussy Riot were targeting the specific connection of church and state, the connection that's grown disturbingly cozy under Putin.
You wrote that the liberal response there has involved language like, they should let these chicks go with a slap on the ass.
Well, that's the thing about Russian liberalism. It is closer to American libertarianism, I think, than what we usually mean by the word liberal. And it's completely normal for Russian liberals, including opposition leaders in public, to use derogatory terms for gays, for example, and generally not concern themselves with the minority rights, women's rights. And feminism is still a bit of a dirty word.
So would it have been better if instead of being cool and using words like ontological, they, in the weird glass box that Russian defendants sit in, they all just burst into tears?
Absolutely. If they decided to enact some sort of over-the-top remorse, yeah, public opinion would turn and their legal fortunes might turn as well. And that is one of the most upsetting things to contemplate, because law should not work like that. The prosecution trotted out this array of sometimes strange characters who claimed to be, you know, mortally offended by Pussy Riot's actions and suffered great emotional damage. One of the things that the members of the band did on the very first day of the trial was to actually ask forgiveness of these people. What's interesting, none of these people, mostly church staff, has accepted their apology. They said it sounded ironic and insincere.
Do you think they have a chance to evade years in prison?
Oddly enough, After the Madonna performance, I feel like they do. I think that nobody in Russia expected the Western attention to the case to crest quite so high. I don't know, I might be unduly optimistic here, but I actually think that it did change things. And the fact that the sentencing was abruptly delayed by 10 days, it did feel like the prosecution and the court, in this case the prosecution and, you know, the judge are pretty much the same side, it felt like they were in a bit of a panic.
So you think Madonna could be crucial in this?
I can't believe I'm saying this, but yes, I do.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Idov is a former contributing editor at New York Magazine and is now editor-in-chief of GQ Russia.
Coming up, a man watches his digital life, all his email, most of the photos of his daughter's first year, and everything on his laptop, his iPhone, his iPad, disappear before his very eyes.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. And now for a few of your letters. A number of listeners weighed in on my use last week when describing the posthumous outing of astronaut Sally Ride of her sexual preference. Many listeners observed that the correct phrasing is sexual orientation, with the lack of choice that that term implies. Daniel Sparler wrote, "How disappointing that in a story on media sensitivity to an historically severely marginalized minority, that host Bob Garfield twice employed the dismissive and patronizing term sexual preference rather than the accurate standard sexual orientation." Others called my phrasing insulting, deliberate, and a host of descriptions ascribing malice. Curiously, nobody quite located my actual failing, momentary carelessness. Anyway, absolutely my bad.
Last week, we spoke with former Onion headline writer Joe Garden about the phenomenon of real news headlines that sound like Onion headlines. We asked you to submit the best ones you could find in the media wild, and we've gotten some great ones so far, like this Guardian headline about the Olympics submitted by listener Cameron McKay. "London 2012. China has no interest in it, and that gives us a chance." Or this Wall Street Journal headline from listener Todd Neistel. "Area man joins organization where nothing much ever happens." Keep them coming. The person who submits the best one, as judged by Joe, will get an On the Media mug. Remember, these headlines must be real, nothing made up.
And now, two forms of cyber war. Last year, when a water pump in Springfield, Illinois, burned out, a Water District employee noticed that the system had been accessed remotely from somewhere inside Russia. 2 days later, a memo leaked from the Illinois Intelligence Fusion Center, made up of state police, members of the FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security, blamed the pump failure on Russian hackers. It looked to be the first example on American soil of the worst-case scenario in cyber warfare, that a hacker could wreak havoc in the physical world.
If a water pumping station was hacked, could this happen to other key facilities like electrical grids, oil and gas stations? And is there any way we can protect ourselves from this?
Last week, a massive, seemingly bipartisan cybersecurity bill was filibustered in the Senate. It died primarily because the Chamber of Commerce and its Senate allies opposed even voluntary standards to protect infrastructure from this kind of attack. Industries, it said, already can and do protect themselves. This cybersecurity bill was just the latest attempt to curb the threat of so-called kinetic attacks that would cause real-world damage. OTM producer Alex Goldman has an update on just how scared you should be.
The alarms have been sounding about attacks like these for years. coming from people like Secretary of Defense and former CIA Director Leon Panetta.
There's a strong likelihood that the next Pearl Harbor that we confront could very well be a cyber attack.
Michigan Congressman Mike Rogers.
A cyber attack that could shut down critical infrastructure and potentially cause physical damage to the United States.
Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid.
The nation's top security experts have said a cyber 9/11 is imminent.
And the screenwriters for the latest movie in the Die Hard franchise.
FAA just issued a critical alert. The entire network went down.
Transportation systems crashing and they just hit the entire financial sector.
These kind of attacks are not only hard to protect against, they're hard to identify. Remember that Illinois water pump that was plagued by Russian hackers? Wired.com reported that Russia was suspected because an independent contractor who worked on the pump had remotely accessed its control systems while vacationing in Russia. Turns out, the Ruskies didn't do it. In fact, to date, there's only been one verified incident of destroying critical infrastructure via computers. That would be Stuxnet, a complex computer worm believed to be a joint effort of Israel and the United States that was used against an Iranian nuclear facility. Reportedly, Stuxnet fooled facility workers by making it look as though the plant was functioning normally, while it turned centrifuges at the plant on and off until they broke apart. But Stuxnet was not a classic cyber attack.
It's not as if some American soldier was simply at a terminal somewhere and sent commands across the internet thousands of miles to Iran and cause something to blow up.
Jerry Brito, director of the Technology Policy Program at George Mason University's Mercatus Center.
In order for Stuxnet to take place, you had to have an amazing investment in traditional intelligence and espionage. You had to have people infiltrate the Natanz facility in Iran. And once they had the weapon, once they had Stuxnet built, they had to get somebody to put it on the computer system. The problem with folks in Congress being hysterical about cyber war is that they're sort of giving short shrift to the fact that Stuxnet was an incredibly difficult. I think the nations that could have the capability that the U.S. would have with Stuxnet are very few.
Evidence of attacks on American infrastructure are so scant, I assumed cyber war was just a convenient fiction, exploited by lawmakers to push unpopular, restrictive internet regulation. But the more I learn about the online vulnerability of U.S. infrastructure, the more serious the threat seems to be. So how scared should you be? Well, to target a piece of infrastructure, cyber warriors would look for what are called SCADA systems, which control industrial processes. Everything from milking machines on dairy farms, to banks of elevators, to water treatment plants. One of the simplest ways to safeguard our infrastructure is to simply keep SCADA systems off of the global internet, a technique that's called air gapping. The reason Stuxnet cannot be remotely installed on computers at the Iranian nuclear plant is because the system was air-gapped. But even though air-gapping SCADA systems is ostensibly the industry standard, that doesn't mean it's always happening.
I worked in quality assurance for GE Energy for 5.5 years.
Aaron Leverett is a security researcher with IOActive.
I heard from my superiors that we didn't need to do a lot of security testing because these devices were never connected to the internet. And that's false on two counts. One, that they are connected to some degree. And secondly, that being disconnected, they would be entirely secure. There are still issues even if you're not connected. So I wanted to combat that.
Leverett found a way to identify over 12,000 SCADA systems connected to the internet, including things like
water treatment facilities, geothermal heat plants, power plants, dams, bridges, train stations.
So should you be scared that, according to General Keith Alexander, head of the National Security Agency, there's been a, quote, 17-fold increase in computer attacks on American infrastructure between 2009 and 2011? Not that scared. None of those attacks have had any impact. There's a vast difference between accessing a poorly secured piece of infrastructure and causing pipelines to explode. More likely, our enemies would combine some form of cyber attack with traditional warfare. John Arquilla is a professor of defense analysis at the U.S. Postnaval Graduate School.
When I introduced the concept of cyber war 20 years ago in an article called Cyber War is Coming, the thing I envisioned most was the use of cyber attacks by militaries in the field to cripple their opponents' responses, in a way similar to the use of air attacks in the initial blitzkriegs of 1939 and 1940. They'd knock out communications. Cyber attacks in Georgia in 2008 did just that and greatly enhanced the ability of the Russians to move forward with few casualties and quite effectively. This is something that I think is a prototype for what can be done on a larger scale in the future.
So should you be scared that Arquilla wholeheartedly believes that we're already in the midst of an escalating cyber war? Not that scared, because he also believes that it may be preferable to traditional warfare.
Throughout all of history, war was just a matter of hurling mass and energy at your opponents. Now, the actual wars that are fought can be waged with far less casualties. I think the possibility of using cyber attack to cripple the military command and control of two countries getting ready to go at it with each other, were it done under some kind of international control, such as the blue helmets of the UN clicking for the cause, that also is pretty cool to think about. The not-so-cool part is, do we, because of the ease of having cyber warfare, do we intervene more often? As Robert E. Lee once said, it is well that war is so terrible, otherwise we should grow too fond of it. Well, cyber war may not be so terrible, and we may grow over fond of it.
In his book, Confront and Conceal, the New York Times' David Sanger shows that the U.S. might already be applying Arquilla's vision of cyber war.
You know, if you look back at what has been different about the Obama approach to national security, it's been the embrace of something called the light footprint strategy to find a way for the United States to be able to deal with its adversaries without sending 100,000 troops, without occupying a nation for 5 years, without spending several hundred billion or $1 trillion. So light footprint strategies involve usually high-tech weaponry that's a lot less expensive and doesn't put personnel at risk. The difficulty, of course, is that in the case of a cyber campaign, not just states hold the monopoly on the weapons here.
Many interviewed for this story shared Sanger's fear that the democratization of technology enables not just nation states, but common criminals, curious hackers, and activist groups like Anonymous to wage war. John Arquilla warns us to beware the boomerang effect.
The first time around with Stuxnet, there may have been some investment required. There are hackers already who have reverse engineered it. And the problem, of course, is that every time you use one of these techniques, you have signaled how to develop these weapons. So yeah, the race is on. And unfortunately, it's not going to be limited to a few great powers. Everybody's in this race.
If everybody's in this race, some kind of regulatory standard for infrastructure security is probably called for. The challenge is accurately assessing the threat without sacrificing individual privacy. Solutions tend to be highly technical and can be difficult for legislators to comprehend. Meanwhile, last week in the material world, three avowed pacifists, ages 57 to 82, broke into the Oak Ridge nuclear facility and spray-painted anti-war slogans on a building that houses nuclear bomb fuel. So should you be scared? Of cyber war? Maybe. Of pacifists within the AARP? Definitely. For On the Media, I'm Alex Goldman.
Now cyber war of a kind writ small. Last week, Wired.com writer Matt Honan lost everything. Hackers deleted his hard drive, iPhone, iPad, hijacked his Gmail, Twitter, and Apple ID accounts. He lost access to 6 years of emails and most of the photos of the first year of his daughter's life. What made the story particularly agonizing was that the hackers were able to break in not because of a mistake Honan made, but because of twin vulnerabilities from two companies many people rely on, Apple and Amazon. Honan actually watched the hack take place, and at first, he didn't know what he was seeing.
So I had gotten home from work a little early. I was playing with my daughter. It was about 5 o'clock, and I noticed my phone went dead. When I went to plug it in, it was in the startup screen, which means that it didn't have anything on it. I thought that my data had just crashed, but I wasn't worried because I had this iCloud account that let me back up my data. But I couldn't log into that, and so I went to my computer to try and back it up from my computer. And when I opened my computer, I could see that my drive was being remotely wiped, and it was asking me for a 4-digit PIN to stop this remote wipe. And I looked at my iPad, and the same thing's happening to my iPad. It had gone to this new startup screen as well, and someone had managed to get into basically all of the electronics I owned and delete all of the data on them at the same time. At that point, I really knew that I was getting hacked and it was going to be bad.
Now, one of the hackers actually got in touch with you pretty quickly to explain how he'd broken in and why.
That's right. I went next door to use my neighbor's computer, and I discovered quickly that they had not only deleted all of my stuff on Apple, but they had deleted my Google account as well. and they had hijacked my Twitter feed. And when I realized that, I set up a second account and I started messaging them, and they messaged me back. And I agreed that I wouldn't prosecute him if he would tell me how he did it.
First of all, why did he do it?
You would think that this was done to get to a bank account or something like that. He did it just to get to my Twitter feed. I had, you know, 14 or so thousand followers, and I only have a 3-character handle because I signed up a long time ago. My name is @MAT, and that's it.
And that kind of a Twitter name is kind of prestigious, right?
They just wanted that. There was no reason that I ever have able to fully get my head around. You know, it was just mayhem. It was just vandalism.
Was this a kid?
He claims to be 19 years old. I wouldn't be surprised if he was even younger than that. But certainly when I started relating to him, you know, look, you deleted a year and a half of pictures of my hard drive, very many of which are the only ones that I have of my baby daughter, you know, who's just 18 months old. And it was clear that this wasn't something that he had thought of before. And I think it's the kind of thing that someone a little bit older would have thought of.
How did he do it? I think this is crucial because it wasn't really your screw up.
They called Amazon and they gave Amazon a bogus credit card number that would still pass through Amazon's authenticator. Then they hung up. Then they called Amazon back and said that they had lost access to their email and needed to add a new email. And this is on a second phone call. And they gave Amazon the credit card that was on file that they had just given Amazon on the previous phone call to prove they had access to the account.
Mm-hmm.
So Amazon then sent them an email to this new address that they had set up that let them go in, look at my account, and find the last 4 digits of a credit card.
Mm-hmm.
What they next did was they called Apple. Apple was only using a few pieces of information to verify your identity. And if you had these 3 pieces, they would issue you a temporary password. If you knew someone's Apple ID, which was my email address, if you knew their billing address, which they are able to look up easily online, and if you know the last 4 digits of a credit card that Apple has on file. So with those pieces of information, the last 4 digits, one of my credit card, my email address, and my physical address, they're able to log into my Apple account. That my Apple account was the backup for my Gmail, so they're able to use that to get to my Google account. And then to kind of cover their tracks, to keep me from being able to go in and do anything about it, they deleted all the data on all my devices, which you can do remotely using these Find My Mac, Find My iPhone, Find My iPad services that Apple offers.
Could anybody have done this?
Once we understood how to do this, it was nothing for us at Wired to replicate this. I mean, we weren't deleting people's devices, but we were able to repeatedly and with a complete success rate get into accounts with just those pieces of information.
Apple and Amazon are not a merged company, but one part of one security system leads you to an item that can get you onto the other security system and enable somebody to unlock the door to all of your stuff.
That's correct. And I actually don't think we've seen the last of this. I don't think this is limited to an Apple and Amazon problem. I think that in the coming years, as we see more and more of our data being stored on the web, as you're trusting people to secure it, we're going to see more and more that people are able to get different little bits and pieces from different places, put them together, and use them to really do some damage.
Explain why you think the stories that followed your story about how to protect yourself kind of miss the point.
Well, a lot of them really focused on Google's two-step authentication.
And that's essentially, if you log in from an unfamiliar computer, you have to verify that it's you using your cell phone. You still would have lost a ton of data, though, right?
That's right. Google's two-step authentication wouldn't have prevented my MacBook from being wiped, my data from being destroyed, because that was done on Apple's system. You know, or a lot of people said, okay, well, Amazon has fixed the problem. You can't get 4 digits of a credit card number from Amazon anymore. But I took a taxi over here to the studio, and I saw the last 4 digits of my credit card displayed on the taxi. The driver saw it, too. The larger problem is that there aren't multiple levels of authentication for most services that are easy to use, because if they're not easy, people aren't going to use them. I'm sure that a lot of people turning on Google two-step authentication in the wake of this story will be turning it off next month, because it can be a pain. The onus needs to be on Apple and Amazon and Google and Microsoft to make really secure, easy systems.
The Luddites out there are probably feeling a bit smug right now. Kind of makes you feel like going off the grid.
It does. Makes me want to move to the woods and just live off of rainwater.
Matt, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Matt Honan writes for Wired.com. Since his original article appeared, Amazon has announced that it's changed the way it verifies account holders' information. Apple spokesperson Natalie Karas told Wired that the company's, quote, internal policies were not followed completely when handing over Honan's information, and that the company has suspended the ability to reset Apple ID passwords over the phone.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Amy DePiro and Eliza Novick-Smith. Amy and Eliza, thank you so much for your help this summer. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, and our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and John DeLore.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.